Welcome to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology Podcast, featuring our neuropsychologists, Dr. Laura Jansons, Dr. Skip Wrenn, and neurofeedback legend, Jake Unkelman. Our goal is to provide information and promote options for better mental health. This is an all-star cast that are more than happy to share their knowledge with you. My name is Pete, and today we're going to catch up on some more listener questions. It'll be another great YouTube show. Jay's got his share screening already, his fingers on the button. But before we get there, we'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Outrageous Baking, Tour Talk, Joshua M., owner of Alternative Behavioral Therapy, EEG, and me, Mara. Welcome aboard, Mara, new Patreon supporter. We're so glad to have you. We also have our Sadia M. and Jonathan Rowe and January Terrell. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery that's been around 15 years. And Tour Talk wants more people to discover TTS, text-to-speech, because listening to text can increase efficiency and reduce stress. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. It really helps get the word out. If they can't hear us, we can't help them. Hey, how about Steve Stern? Any news on him, guys?
I heard he might be riding off into the sunset. I think he's going to retire.
What's the news, Skip?
We received notification from Steve, longtime friend, as longtime provider of great equipment from Stens, that he is going to retire. And the company's going to keep going, but Steve's going to enjoy Northern California without going to work every day, I think.
Oh, so that means he's moving to Colorado or Wyoming?
Maybe. I don't know. Some people like paying a lot of taxes. I don't know.
Mind Media and Irwin. We got to get Irwin on. See what what's the latest going on over there. So, Jay, what do you got for us today? We were finishing up Tor's question last week. He was talking about,
initially he was discussing dyslexia. Dyslexia is seen as a presentation in QEG. It's not usually identifiable in the raw EEG because this is a subtlety, not a epileptiform discharge or a gross abnormality. It's a subtlety. So you don't go to the hospital to get an EEG for dyslexia. They won't basically get paid for that. That's not an indication for it. But the QEG can show things that are much more subtle. Jack Johnstone, many years ago, he was my old business partner, published about dyslexia as QEG correlates, and it showed a central parietal slow feature that generally is correlated with white matter change in the area, which essentially is sensory processing issue. More recently, there's been identification of left posterior temporal parietal junction, Wernicke area involvement with people that have dyslexia. In Tortok's note, there was kind of a throwaway sentence about families having it being common in families, and that that was actually something that was real. And, you know, he doesn't have to convince me. We can actually show there is a genetic biomarker that's associated with dyslexia dyscalculia. And that's that left temporal feature, not the parietal sensory integration issue that's generally diagnosed as dyslexia. This genetic biomarker is for the temporal finding. Is there a reason for that familial linkage? Well, there you go. It's not such a dominant gene that a dyslexic's children have to be dyslexic, but the family line will tend to have dyslexia loaded in it. Anyway, there was some reality to that. He went on in another topic, basically, to discuss epilepsy. And in fact, he said he wasn't going to be able to be attending. He'd have to catch the video of today's podcast because he was going to be in a consult with an epileptologist because of the remarkable recovery of an intractable epileptic that the epileptologist didn't expect to have any recovery. and their meeting to discuss that. And he wanted to know whether I had something, you know, basically, what about Jay about that? And in front of you now, basically, you should see an abstract. This is a document in submission right now. And this is a young girl who at the time was having 250 uncontrolled seizures a day. And those basically, some of them were life-threatening with cessation of respiration. And basically going from unable to even do simple self-care to becoming a Division I tennis star in the United States. And this progression from intractable epilepsy to being seizure-free and medication-free took a period of time, and it wasn't quick and easy, but this is an extreme case. This took over 500 neurofeedback sessions. The authors in this are Rusty Turner, Sue Wilson, who's a peak performance psychologist for elite sports, myself, Alexandra, who's the mother of Isabella. This is done with as a case report with the full permission as an adult by the patient and the mother. They basically are going to talk about her case and present it, and having a document with her actually identified in it is helpful for that advocacy that they intend to do. But this is, as I say, in submission. This is, I think, number six of the series of intractable epileptics that I've worked with, all of which have become seizure-free medication. You know, all the people that wonder if neurofeedback works, you generally don't go seizure-free, medication-free if you're an intractable severe epileptic. It's a long-standing condition.
That's a student athlete too, right, Jay?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's talk about stress. On top of your university studies, you've got extreme amount of time. Yeah, I was a student athlete swimmer, and you know, 4 hours of extra workout and stuff a day really takes a chunk out of your university study time. So you have to really be dedicated to do that stuff. But you know, her tennis was her motivation as well. So this is one of six, and they're all, as I say, medication-free, seizure-free. Maggie is a case in Michigan, and she's actually had some video footage on her and her family. She went from being intractable epilepsy with ESES, electrographic status epilepticus of sleep, where you fall asleep and you have seizures, it wakes you back up. She's seizure-free, medication-free as well. But Tortok's concern over what's going on with the intractable epilepsy, there's actually publications about intractable epilepsy and neurofeedback. There's a meta-analysis by Gabriel Tan that's specifically about this as well. I would suggest that working with epilepsy is absolutely a wonderful idea, but it's not, you really in life have to kind of expect the unexpected. Let's look at some current data. So this is a current publication, Springer, European Child and Adolescent Psychiatry Journal. And this is looking at epileptiform activity in kids and what's its prevalence in various categories and what's the implication for treatment approach. And, you know, there's some of the usual suspects, Ron Swasina, Martine Arns, Dr. Tarno's a psychiatrist in Houston, Robert Turner Rusty. Some of these were grad students working with Ron earlier. I don't know whether they've graduated or what they're up to at this point. And then Nash is actually a fairly well-known internationally as an electroencephalographer. Cut to the chase, this is a meta-analysis. What they're showing is that in ADD, ADHD, you can see epileptiform content on the average about 25% of the time or more. And that's, you know, ADD, ADHD, this isn't somebody who's having seizures. This is somebody who's got attentional regulatory problems. And is present in about a quarter of them. So if you don't look, you may prescribe a medication that exacerbates it. If you're treating a discharge with an anticonvulsant and the person needs a stimulant for ADD, that's okay. But if you're not treating the seizure discharge, that same stimulant may trigger an increased probability of seizures. So actually looking before you work with this class of patients is important. And if you prescribe a medication and they have an unexpected response, for goodness sakes, at least look then. Now, in anxiety disorders, you know, it's double the 3 to 5% of the normal population that have epileptiform findings, but it's not a gigantic number. It's just double the background. But the autism spectrum, my goodness, they're running about 60% of the autism spectrum have epileptiform content in the EEG. And, you know, 60% is awfully good odds. You know, you go to Vegas with 60%, you come back rich, you know. So this, if you're working with autism and you're not looking at the EEG to identify epileptiform discharges, you're really below what should be the standard of practice. If you're not looking to find this, you won't know how to treat it. If you actually see the discharges, there's some physicians that can end up prescribing appropriate medication, and there are neurofeedback protocols that can specifically address epileptiform discharges. So mood disorders down to the, you know, depression, down to the background population, 3% or so. And psychotics, about a third of the psychotics end up having epileptiform discharges. And this influences how you treat them. Well, it should. I mean, if you don't look and don't know, it doesn't influence the damn thing how you treat them. But if they have epileptiform discharges, antipsychotic medications decrease the seizure discharge threshold and you get worse. So you give them more antipsychotic medication. It's obviously a mistake. And also lithium can also make it worse. But an anticonvulsant used as a stabilizing agent in psychiatry is the appropriate response when you see epileptiform content in a psychiatric patient. Importance of looking at the EEG in psychiatry and in neurofeedback work is really critical. You know, as I say, expect the unexpected. You're going to see epileptiform discharges in the EEG if you know what you're looking at in your clinical cases. Anyway, I think that's it for that topic.
I have a question, and it's a wide net question for sure. I'm just trying to wrap my head around behaviors that are associated with these labels or disorders that you mentioned. right? Which are observable symptoms. And then also how behaviors are generated neurologically. And here's what I'm trying to wrap my head around. And I don't know if it's one simple answer. I doubt it. Can you say something to how this epileptiform discharge contributes to the behaviors that we know as ADHD, that we know as, you know, autism spectrum disorder, as we anxiety disorder, right? It goes in so many different directions. What's the common thread? Like if you have epileptiform discharge, can that account for distractibility? Like, hey, you know, you're having a shorting out upstairs and so you're not paying attention. Obviously, I'm simplifying.
Yeah. But absolutely. The turf that the discharge occupies ends up changing its symptom presentation.
Right.
And you know, if it's affecting the frontal lobe, your ability to track things and attend to things is going to be disrupted. And as an example, a well-known discharge that's seen in absence epilepsy, a 3 per second spike in wave, that can be 500 to 1,500 microvolts. And a perception is 5 to 10 microvolts worth of content. And if you get hit with a 300 to 500 to 1,500 wave, that tsunami, the little ship is lost. You know, your attention is on Gilligan's Island at that point. There's no way to track anything. So the frontal lobe can be disturbed. Now, more subtle, little tiny discharges that are epileptiform can also hijack it without being a 3 per second spike in wave. Many years ago now, I think 2009, perhaps, Yuri Kropotov and I lectured together in Australia. And he did the ERP section of the presentation, and they had done a recording. One of the neurologists in the audience had volunteered to do the CPT task. It's the most boring task in the world. You're looking at stuff and pressing a button for 20 minutes, you know, and go, no go task. So I stepped out of the room, caught up on, texting back to my partner and catching up on email, and stepped back in as they were starting to go through the EEG to prep it for analysis. And you want to cut out artifacts. Well, as they're scanning through, I say, oh, back it up. Look, an epileptiform discharge left frontally. And the neurologist says, I know it's there. It's meaningless. I'm surprised anybody even saw it. And, that's an interesting theory, that this is a meaningless discharge. And he's a neurologist. This is exactly what they believe. Well, a CPT task was just run. And he had 2 omission errors, which was not outside normal. He had no commission errors, very good reaction time, very low variability. But the 2 omissions happened when 2 discharges happened. The 2 times his brain had a discharge, he skipped the response. So his attentional focus on the task, which was perfect otherwise, was hijacked by the discharge. Now, tell me that was a meaningless discharge again,
right?
You know, and he had to admit, my God, you know, he was shocked. You know, you don't know that you're missing it. You miss it. You know, it's a piece missing. It's not, you don't, there's no flag. Hey, you're missing a piece. It's just a hijack. Now it can happen elsewhere. If you have a temporal lobe discharge, you can have pseudobulbar affect, out of control laughter. Gelastic seizures are a fit of laughter. Now, it's not funny to the person who's doing the laughing. I mean, they're not laughing because like they tickled their funny bone. This is out of control. This is hysterical laughter. And it's actually quite disturbing to the person who's having it. And there's other emotions, just, you know, many emotions can end up. And rage from a temporal lobe epileptic discharge is also extremely common. Out of control rage. The individual quite often doesn't even have an adequate memory of what happened when it's done. And occasionally will end up having hurt themselves in the process. So, you know, depending upon where it is. Now, if it hits the motor strip and you have a seizure, you're the one that gets to go see the neurologist and gets an anticonvulsant. But if it's in the frontal lobe, unless you're caught with a 3 per second spike in wave staring spell, you're likely not to get seen. You know, you're going to be diagnosed with an ADD, you know, attentional problem. And you have an attentional problem, but it's a different etiology than simple ADD. Different spot, different symptom, right posterior temporal parietal junction, Asperger's autism type presentations, left side, you have lexical processing over there. You can have mute autism. If you can't comprehend, you can't speak, you know, you end up with the discharge appropriate to the symptoms that are present. Occipital discharges are usually judged in neurology. They're called benign juvenile, you know, occipital benign juvenile epilepsy. And they typically have not treated it historically because there's no seizure. What's to treat if you're not having a seizure? Well, the hallucination, the sensory processing problem. And more recently, now that they have neuroimaging, they're finding cortical dysplasias, little structural anomalies. They're starting to actually do treatment, and it helps treat the sensory problems and hallucinations. Usually Tegretol or Trileptal or Lamictal will be used. And the occipital spikes, again, aren't going to cause seizures, so they're considered benign.
Yeah, you said anyway, if you don't know what you're looking for, I don't know if you have any a couple EEGs or picks at the ready just to show the rookie techs what it looks like.
Oh, well, that's entirely possible. Let me pop up a...
Go ahead.
We've got monozygotic twins here. This twin has seizures, and... we can look at this EEG pretty easily. These are spike and wave discharges coming out of the parietal area and the central area with phase reversals here on the left central cortical area. So this person was having seizures. They're treating this person with an anticonvulsant. But as you can see, these discharges in the temporal area, parietal area, central area are happening continually all the way through the EEG. So this twin has epilepsy, but, you know, the other twin, again, a monozygotic twin, no seizures, diagnosed with dyslexia and a learning disability. Don't you know that their monozygotic twins have the same phenotype? And as you start to go through the EEG, I think you'll recognize the twins. Totally different diagnosis because this twin wasn't having seizures, but they're having sensory processing problems that are really quite profound. So the behavioral DSM diagnosis, notice the little attitude about the DSM diagnosis of dyslexia or sensory processing problem, didn't look at the phenotype. When you come up with a guess, which is all the DSM is, it's a guess, you should do some testing to find out what the pathophysiology is, because there's many clusters within the DSM, you know, DSM category, because the DSM is not specific. Even for OCD, where there's only one kind of OCD in the DSM, there's three EEG endophenotypes associated with it. This twin with obvious epileptiform discharges, we've got parietal spikes here, thus the learning disability. PC is a sensory integration cortex. And if it's getting hit by a tsunami of a giant wave, you're not going to be able to perceptually track anything. So her sensory processing problem, which was the symptom, was accurate, but the pathophysiology is totally different than somebody that has a normal dyslexia or learning disability. You want some EEG, you got some EEG. So, and the spike in wave is what you see. This is the mathematics of spike detection. This is the spike. The duration of the spike has to be between 20 and 70 milliseconds for this algorithm to spot it. Those of you who really know, 20 to 60 is the formal definition. However, if they don't set this out to 70, the algorithm misses spikes that the doctor would call. And the doctor's call is the gold standard, not the mathematical definition of 20 to 60. So they had to widen this out to match up with the doctor's eyes. When I started in EEG, the definition without digital EEG, just on paper, that was 20 to 80. But, you know, on paper, there's ink and width and absorption, and you know, the precision is not quite there for measurements. And we would measure a little broader in the old days for what was considered a spike. And the slow wave has to be within 150 milliseconds of the spike onset in order to be associated with it. Otherwise, they're just unrelated. This is a classic spike algorithm, and this could be passed over the EEG to identify the spikes in a more automated way. But the doctor's eyes, again, are the gold standard.
And then, Jay, we had a Nina question on PTSD. I don't know if Skip or Dr. Laura wants to touch on her question.
Read through the question,
yeah.
She's in Melbourne, Australia. Apparently people in other time zones catch this other than just early morning right. Here in California.
California. You
know? In Melbourne, she's looking to treat her fairly complex PTSD. She's been offered a rental of a neuro-optimal device. She was wondering, because she really couldn't find anything further about it when she was trying to research it on PTSD. She had heard about neurofeedback because of Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score bestseller for, I think, 40 weeks or some damn thing on the New York Times bestseller list. A very popular book. And during COVID, imagine, people just snapped that up, you know, left and right. So she had heard about neurofeedback, and she was basically wondering about that device. Now, I welcome comments from Skip and Laura, but I've got comments as well. And there's a lot of advancing technologies for dry sensor. Sense AI just put out their Indiegogo fund thing. They've got somewhere close to $1 million worth of orders already, and it's a well designed device. I've seen it and have advised them on the quality of their amplifier, and advised them some on the kind of analysis that would end up being appropriate for that kind of a device. But there are other deals, the crown, which kind of grabs the sides of your head. It doesn't have the midline, but it has temporal and lateral and posterior sites that are covered. Different devices end up having different locations. You can have Cognionics All-19 dry sensor technologies as well. But the question here was basically specifically about the neuro-optimal, which is a classic device. It's been around for quite a long time. Val Brown, the owner and developer of it, is an old friend of mine. I've known him for a long, long time. Have to divulge that. He's actually contributed some interesting ideas, like not just having a lower threshold that something has to be above, but also having an upper threshold that it shouldn't be above. Range for your filtering. And that was a unique contribution to the field that nobody had done prior to him. So there's some very interesting approaches. He does have a background that orients him towards chaos theory and that as an explanation for how his device works. The neuro-optimal device was not, when they filed for their FDA clearance, they filed for it as a general health and wellness device, as opposed to a neurofeedback device. Now, it's a different category. And they argued that you don't have to do anything. Just, you can turn it on like background music. And that you don't have to pay attention. There's nothing that the person has to do. And as such, it's not really neurofeedback. This is chaos theory. Feedback into a system will allow the system to self-regulate and change state. And you know, systems theory predicts that feedback will do that. Now, they do limit their suggested locations to C3, C4. And they have a built-in software approach to how that all runs. So it's one size fits all in that respect. And it's fairly limited in its location. And they're limited to not making any kind of a claim. It's a general health and wellness device, like taking a daily vitamin. But this is not something that's used to treat anything. It's used for general health and wellness. Now, there are people that say, well, during my general health and wellness treatment, my lumbago got better, or whatever the symptom might have been. Yeah, it's just a joke symptom. I don't even know what the hell lumbago would be. So I heard on old cowboy movies, you know. Something got better. Well, yeah, that's an anecdote, and nobody can use an anecdote to really support anything. The device has specifically not done research on it. Val adamantly will not do research because research would require you to like categorize a DSM category. And this is a general health and wellness thing. You can't do that and still have your general health and wellness description. So it'll be outside. You know, FDA regulates manufacturers and their claims. You can be a non-Mac manufacturer that makes claims about a device, but the manufacturer has to be careful what they do, or they get crosswise with the FDA. As a general health and wellness device, it has been tested a couple of times. There was a woman I can't recall her name off the top of my head, at the ISNR meeting. They had tested a bunch of different devices for people that had attentional and learning issues. And it came out basically in the middle of the pack. It wasn't the outcomes weren't stellar, but it wasn't like there wasn't some benefit. So, you know, it's a general health and wellness device. You can't make a claim when it has been tested. It didn't look like a stellar device. But if you have a specific DSM category or a biomarker endophenotype divergent pattern, yeah, you should think seriously about actually working with somebody that has a credential in that area. Look at the full EEG more for an evaluation and kind of a protocol development. And it may not just be C3, C4. I mean, Historically, C3, C4 was, those were common spots. The Othmers originally did C3 beta, C4 SMR. Quite common. The device of NeuroOptimal is actually a very good amplifier. In fact, the manufacturer of the NeuroOptimal amplifier is Larry Woodard, Phoenix Electronics, or I can't remember what they call their company. They OEM their amp out to not just Val Brown, but also many other groups within the neurofeedback world, and Jim Hart for his amps and filters. So, classic design. Larry Woodard was my lab partner in 1972, and we had a company together called Spectral Data Systems that made EMG and temperature devices that were FDA registered back in the 70s. So, he goes a long way back and does a very good job designing amplifiers. So it's a solid device. It has its limitations on topography to C3, C4. And I think there are a lot of other interesting brain areas. It's a general wellness device. And if you've got a specific claim like complex PTSD, you may consider actually finding a person to do a full workup. PTSD commonly ends up with the right posterior temporal parietal finding. We've discussed that. A specific location, I think, a number of times earlier.
On that note, Jay, the latter part of what you were saying, we've had a guest on before, Dr. Andrew Hill, Peak Institute out of LA. I think they might be St. Louis too. And they do remote neurofeedback, meaning they'll send you the equipment, yep, et cetera, and walk you through how to do a cue and kind of get you up and running on how to do the training sessions. Just because the listener asked, hey, anything else maybe to consider? So there's something maybe to consider. And I happen to know that Andrew does work with people down under, as they say.
I knew Dr. Hill when he was looking around for his doctoral program and recommended UCLA to him.
Andy.
So, yeah.
Back when he was just Andy.
Yeah, I recognize his email address, he was a student looking for a university, and I recognized him online as a kind of a serious person, and there weren't, he was looking for an accredited university with a PhD program in neurofeedback way back then, and you say you're going to do a neurofeedback PhD, it's a good way to ruin your career back then. So, to a certain extent, there's still locations that's likely the case. But Aaron Zeidel had a brain lateralization lab. And I think Aaron passed just recently. Andy was doing C3, C4 evaluation of subjective experience with SMR and beta frequencies. So, early work and important early work. But he was a serious student, got his PhD at a serious university.
Yeah, I was thinking of, I think we've all probably seen Bessel van der Kolk talk before. He has a signature EEG pattern for folks with PTSD, and it includes the front left, and so what is that, F3, and then right central, so C4 probably. And his discussion about that was that we have the fight or flight response, which is going to be amygdala right side, but we also have a freezing in, what we want to say. So when we're spooked, we get frozen and we can't say anything, and we're kind of holding whatever. We just kind of can't do anything or say anything. And that's the front left. Interesting pattern that he came up with that he saw pretty frequently. And then the other thing, I think this is something Jay brought up when we were communicating about this question beforehand, that PTSD is a serious business, and you're going to have differing, patterns, and, to kind of treat yourself at home, there's a lot of risk to that, if you're not trained in psychology and you know, the different treatments and different presentations. What was your phrase, Jay, that you have a fool for being your own attorney? I think you said that.
That's a classic, you know. If you've got a complex circumstance, it's best to find somebody who's expert in that area. And self-treatment when there's a complex circumstance is your perfect right. But, you know, as I say, if you're your own lawyer, you've got a fool for a client. You've got to look carefully when there's a circumstance like that at an outside perspective. When your brain function has been compromised, it's especially important to get an outside perspective.
We're trying to help out moms and dads out there that are on a budget. And I'm just throwing out some things here and you guys can poke holes in them, but there's a lot of online groups, Facebook, pick your platform, that are selling used equipment.
And there's lots of options out there that are emerging devices like the Sense AI device, which is oriented to the person. Divergence Neuroscience in Canada ends up having an orientation towards the therapist managing the case. And the therapist would design the protocol. They would use the Crown system as the device that would end up being used. The data ends up being hooked through a cell phone to the internet, but it's, there's direct feedback provided. There's lots of approaches that are orienting towards the individual. And there, again, it's good to have some solid professional advice before doing self-treatment if you've got something severe or significant, but you can also end up with a device that's oriented towards the therapist managing, changing thresholds, running the session remotely, and that sort of a thing. And again, Divergence Neuro up in Canada has a software package and everything oriented towards therapists managing remote devices. Very much like I give free advice to the iSync people in Korea and Sense AI, I also have given free advice to the Divergence folks and, you know, pretty much anybody else that's foolish enough to listen to me. So I have to just, you know, declare that as well.
Maybe we should have the iSync people on here.
Well, the time of day would probably have to be altered a little bit. I mean, they're in Seoul, Korea. So,
12, 13 hours. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll try and get a hold of them.
We've had them sometimes attending, things that I've done, in the morning here, and it's like the middle of the night there. So it's not something they can do commonly, but I'm sure that they would be happy to be on. They've developed quite the nice database and also a helmet system that has the dry sensors and photobiomodulation. But the dry sensor can go through a cell phone or a tablet through to the cloud server with their AI, They come back with an answer very quickly within minutes with respect to whether the pattern matches mild cognitive impairment or dementia or normal aging. So
I think if you're listening, I know it's tomorrow, but if you got an extra cap you want us to try, we're up for it.
Well, they're, I believe that they're in process with the FDA. They are Korean FDA'd, and they've actually got their device in active use. They just received a second year in a row major awards for the for their developments of AI and cognitive detection and the device as well as their database. So they were the first database to have gender specific norms, and you know, everybody else combines male and female. And, you know, I can tell the difference, can't you? You know, and the database, once you end up with a full database of the two, you can end up seeing the differences. During the developmental trajectory, there's significant differences. And with aging, there's also differences. 45 years old on up, females light up with gamma and fast activity. Males go electrically cerebral silent. You know, it's really a striking difference. And if you can combine a lot of gamma with almost none, what do you get? Something you don't want to be compared to. You know, you want to be compared to your own specific gender. So anyway, they've got a wonderful approach, and I've known them for decades. So
you tell them I'm going to reach out to them. They better pick up the phone. A lot of people are asking about how to do it at home, and they're almost there, it sounds like. We thank you all for listening to NeuroNoodles, Neurofeedback, and Neuropsychology Podcast. We'd like to thank our Patreon supporters, Outrageous Baking, Tor Talk, Joshua M., owner of Alternative Behavioral Therapy, EEG and Me, Mara, welcome aboard, Mara, new one, Sadia M., and Jonathan Rowan, January Terrell. Outrageous Baking is a dedicated gluten-free bakery that's been around for 15 years. And Tor Talk wants more people to discover TTS, text-to-speech, because listening to text can increase efficiency and reduce stress. Hey, do you have an idea for a topic? Please email Pete at neuronoodle.com or leave us a voicemail with a link in the podcast notes. Please give us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, which is growing like gangbusters. Smash that like button on Facebook, Instagram, follow us on Twitter. And again, hey, if you really, really, really like us, you can buy us a coffee on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. We love our Patreon peeps, don't we, Jay?
You got it. You know, you're getting so many of them, we've got to have rolling credits at the end for our Patreon supporters.
We're going to give them as much value as we can, Jay. Cue the music.